Members only. Dum da dum 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 dum. What's up, Rob?
It's a nice jingle. Well, why don't we should get that made into something? I like it.
I just came up with that. Just came up with that on my own. Dude, I don't know why, but I always, which was a, in Austin Powers, which the original Austin Powers was an excellent comedy. The sequels ended up kind of like falling off a little bit. And it was in, I think, one of the sequels. But to me, for whatever reason, Rob, this was just to me like the funniest thing I'd ever seen in my life. But when Dr. Evil is just around the piano and he's gone back in time and he's just singing "What If God Was One of Us?" And then at the end of it, he just goes, I came up with that. Yeah, I made that up. And I just, there's just something about having access to time travel and of all the things to claim, like of all the things, like to you, of all the songs, even like that song. And then, yeah, I just came up with that. I don't know why. To me, it's just the funniest go back in the past and brag about something of all time. Brilliant movies. Will Ferrell in that first one, unbelievable.
Yeah, I gotta rewatch those. It's been a long time, but those were so funny.
Great, just so great. What's his name? From Family Guy,
Seth Green,
just phenomenal in that.
You know, dude, the scene. You know that part was offered to Colin Quinn and he turned it down.
I did not know that. That's a whole different movie, man. Goddamn.
Yeah.
Well, that was stupid. Why was Colin Quinn turning down major parts in a huge movie?
Oh,
who did Colin Quinn think he was?
He talked about it on O&A, and that's literally what he said. He said, I was trying to get my own movies made. That was literally a character I'd played on SNL, and Mike Myers offered it to me, and I turned it down because I thought I was getting my own shit made.
Well, he was on SNL at a time when people were becoming huge stars. So, listen, Colin Quinn is one of the greatest, in my opinion, one of the greatest comedians of all time, man. That guy's just incredible. He would have been really funny as that part, too. And Seth Green was great, but he would have done that. You know, he would have been great. But, dude, the scene when they're in group therapy, and Mike Myers as Dr. Evil delivers the scene of his childhood. Yeah. Dude, it's one of the funniest monologues in the history of comedy, dude. It's just the greatest thing.
Anyway. Married to a French hooker. I don't remember the whole thing. I just remember how specific it is.
Oh, yeah. He's just giving his detailed story, and every little detail of it is hilarious. Like, I don't even remember the details, but he's
just
I just remember
the web feed. My father was a man of little words and web feed or something.
I remember one. He goes, he was a mad genius. He goes, he would make outrageous claims, like he invented the question mark. all right. So let's talk about some stuff more in our wheelhouse for this show. Goddamn, Rob. You know, I don't know. I've been thinking a lot. It's good. I love these family vacations, getting a lot of sun and playing with the kids and swimming in the pool and stuff. And it levels me out, gets me away from the stress of being me and the burden that I have in this world of still having failed to teach everybody economics, something like that. Man, Rob, I really wish, it's all I've been thinking about lately. Been reading like Bob Murphy articles and stuff for whatever reason. I'm just, it's all the Democratic Socialists. And then J.D. Vance being a socialist himself, too. It's just been what I've been thinking about. It's what I ranted about on the show yesterday. And like, I just wish America wasn't always, hadn't been bombing everyone over the last decade. And just been funding and starting every stupid war. So I just could have been going on Rogan and Tucker and trying to convince everybody to believe in free markets. Just wish that at all, that all that was going on. Maybe I could have done it, Rob, instead of failing so miserably like we are now. Anyway, part of the reason why I've been thinking about this is because, and I have not talked to him yet. I feel like this is almost like perfect, this being a members only, and I haven't talked to him yet. But Tucker Carlson made this pretty big announcement that he wants to start a third party.
Cool. I actually didn't see that.
In America. And yeah, maybe... Even Natalie, could you just Google that? Tucker Carlson, third party, and let's pull up exactly what he said. But immediately, my thought is like, okay, I got to get on the phone with Tucker because I want to talk to him about this. It's really interesting. I don't know that this is the right thing. Like, I would almost be like,
pod.
I don't know.
He might do it.
Well, He would. I'm sure he would. He's done the pod before, twice, right? He did. I think he did Part of the Problem twice, and I've done his show so three times, four times. I mean, I'm sure we could make it happen. And we're friends. I mean, we talk like fairly regularly. So I will talk to him about this, but the reason why I was saying it's good timing almost because is what ends up happening with these things is that if I talked to him this morning about it, I couldn't come do a podcast on it. You know what I mean? Because then it's like, oh, well, I don't know exactly what was on the record and off the record. And maybe there's some plans he doesn't want to announce yet or whatever. But since I haven't, I can talk about it freely. But anyway, right away, my mind is just kind of like, well, I don't know, man, is it better? I don't know if that's the right move or if it's better to just use the Republican Party. You're Tucker Carlson, after all, you know? Oh, yeah, Natalie, by the way, people get your questions or comments in, and then Natalie put them in as the deal with all the members only episodes. You know, I don't know if it's the right move or not, but then also at the same time, you're like, yo, dude, there is some truth to, like, Rob, as you know, we talk about all the time, you know, you pull from outside of just the Republican base, there's access to another huge pull, you know, being against the war in Iran, being, you know, for government transparency, these are really popular issues with independents and some Democrats too. So, and then right away, I'm like, oh yeah, shit, but what are the economics of this thing going to be? You know, Rob, because whatever.
Populist, that's your answer.
Yeah, well, right. But that not begs a question, not the logical sense, but that leads to a pretty big question of what exactly, there's a whole lot of devil in those details, right? So the thing becomes, if Tucker Carlson is serious about leading some type of political movement in America, well, I mean, well, goddamn, dude, then I'm on board with that because fuck, dude. I mean, Rob, me and you, I know. It's almost like the popular thing is now this kind of like podcast wars and it, all this fighting. And don't get me wrong, like me and you participate in that as much as anybody because we're playing clips of Ben Shapiro and Michael Knowles and tearing them apart and making fun of Mark Levin and shit. But like with all this stuff going on, I know a lot of people go real hard at Tucker Carlson. Rob, me and you have watched this guy through his coverage of COVID, the Ukraine war, the Syrian civil war, Gaza, Iran twice now. This guy's been the goddamn like best political commentator in the country. He's the biggest. He's got this huge audience of millions of people, and his foreign policy is like phenomenal. He's good on government corruption. He's good on like all these important issues. But I guess, anyway, the long and the short of all this is that if me and you then, Rob, have a role to any degree in that coalition, it is going to be fighting the entire time about why we should be free market, laissez-faire capitalists, you know?
At least
part of the time.
This falls into the lane of something I've said before, that I can wrap my head around a Glenn Greenwald liberal. And if Glenn Greenwald was running the country tomorrow, that'd be a massive improvement, and there'd be a lot of socialism to kind of argue with him about. If Tucker Carlson were to create a third party, and let's just say they're victorious, let's just imagine this for a second. If there's actually a new party that wants to step into office that's going to get us out of foreign wars, fix the immigration problem, which, you know, the border seems to be closed at the moment, and then also really go after DC corruption, and at the same time have more socialism that I'd like, and continue the bubble economy, it's not the worst compromise. And we can argue, you know, we could point out, hey, I want to let you know you're doing great on these two fronts, but on this third front, you're still creating a problem and keeping the economy from actually growing. And this is actually what's getting in the way of poor people having more money and having higher real wages. But at the end of the day, if you actually had someone who stepped in who wants to go after DC corruption and keep us out of wars, I mean, you're talking about, literally, I mean, it's 75% of the problem, or maybe it's 60% of the problem. No, like I'm saying, the economy is a huge thing, but like, yeah, if you can clean up that other stuff, I don't know. I'll take it for a term.
Well, it's also, and look, of course, and I'm not, I don't mean to imply that you were disagreeing with this at all, but it's also, it's, you know, they're not separate issues. They are one and the same. It's the military socialism that, you know, we're kind of talking about here. And so, yes, you're essentially saying, well, you're going after this huge socialist enterprise. And so, man, it does suck if there are some other socialist enterprises there. But that being said, I'm just making the point that we are going to be the ones arguing with them the whole time that this socialism is stupid and you shouldn't be doing that. Cause like, I just can't not, you know, and I don't know, Rob, we're right about this stuff. So why do we have to compromise on all of this? It's just, I don't know, man, after a while, this is, like I said, this is what the vacation gets me away from. Sorry, members. This is what you get for sending me money is me. You get to be in my therapy session, but the burden of all this shit, I don't mean to sound like too much of an asshole, but it's like, no, dude, how about you guys get on board with our program? Cause we're right about all this stuff. And I'm not like saying that in a, like, I can't back that up way. I'm saying like, no, how about none of us leave the room until one of you can try to pin us down on this argument because you don't have it. We are right. Like, this is the thing yesterday. You're just manipulating prices. That doesn't actually help anybody. And I don't know. There's a reason why. Again, you know, I try to even gently say this with like Anna Kasparian and Cenk Uygur, because I did shows with both of them recently. But I kind of said in one way where I was like, I don't know, dude, if I was watching the Young Turks in 2017 or 2018, I'd probably disagree with a lot of what you guys are saying. But when I'm watching you guys, you know, cover Gaza and Iran, I agree with much of it. Now, I was just kind of making the point gently that it's like, I haven't changed, right? Like, if you were doing this same stuff back then, I would have been agreeing with what you said back then. I was always against the wars. I was always against the COVID restrictions. I was always against the, you know what I mean? Like, me and you were right about all that stuff in real time. And we're also right about this. So we're not going to shut up about it. I don't know.
With all that, I will listen. You have a personal relationship with Tucker. I've never met or interacted with the guy. I didn't watch him at all when he was on Fox News. It was of zero interest to me. Since he's switched over to the podcasting space, sometimes he has a guest on and they're going deep on some stuff that I think is fascinating. So I pay more attention to him in the podcast space, and he captures more of my interest. And anyways, he still is a little bit of an institutional player, and I would not personally hop on to endorse it until I see how it plays out, because it could be a party that platforms JD Vance against Marco Rubio as a theoretical.
We got to see what ends up coming of any of this. And anytime the point you're making, anytime you're talking about starting a political party, well, it's only going to be as strong as the candidates you're able to run. It doesn't matter what the party stands for, in the same sense that it doesn't matter what the Libertarian Party, me and you, Rob, if we really got into, which I have, and I do not say this to brag, I say this more as, again, therapy, reliving past trauma, but I have actually read, I think, the entire platform, including the bylaws and stuff, because it was just one of the things I had to do when we were getting involved in the Mises thing. I was like, what does this all say? What do I want to change, if there is anything? And like, I'll just tell you, you could take my word for it. I know you pretty well and your views. I'll say, you'd find some things. You'd probably find a few things that you'd be like, I would change that. I would put that out of the platform. I'd put this into the platform. But overall, dude, if you were comparing it to like the Democratic or Republican platform, you'd be like, dude, this platform is fucking awesome, dude. It's the whole goddamn thing. It's about slashing taxes and regulations. And so it's like, yeah, absolutely. But if Chase Oliver is the candidate, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what it says in that thing. So, you know, this is always going to be the case with third parties. But, there's also the aspect of what's bigger than that, which is like the kind of the movement. Because we also don't want just one great candidate. You want a party that could field 15 great candidates for different, you know, important offices. But I don't know. I guess also part of how I feel, you know, me and you talk about this sometimes. And I guess maybe, you know, because me and you were whatever, we've been friends for like 15 years or something like that. And I've been, I don't know, successful for like 7 years or something. So like half of our friendship was you with me before anything was going on in my career or whatever. And it, if you even remember, because not everyone like knows this as intimately as you do, but you were in the New York comedy scene with me in those years, in 2013 and 2014 and 2015, when really, if you remember, Rob, like, you were always, and particularly because you were younger then at the time, but you were always kind of like filthy. You always had a lot of like, I don't know, just like edgy, kind of dark comedy material was always kind of your thing. And then you started like incorporating more political stuff into your stand-up, like over the years, as you kind of matured and got, and just got more focused on it, I guess. But I was like the political comedian. Like, that was kind of different. It wasn't what most people were talking about. Like, I was the guy that was like, as soon as I started doing stand-up, you'd be like, oh, this guy like reads about fucking history in the news and shit and has jokes about this. And then when Trump became the candidate and then later the president, it was like every comedian became a political comedian. And that was the burden of me, was that I was just like, hey, I was already here doing this. And there's some advantages in that, because then I got some kind of, I got a little more practice on everybody on, you know, doing this thing or whatever. But I don't know, Rob, there is a very weird dynamic. This has happened to me with every like almost major story in the news, in the history of this podcast, where like, okay, for whatever reason, I just, and look, there's exceptions to this. There were things like, I had never read anything about virology until COVID came around. And then you had to really quickly on the fly, me and you had to figure out like, well, we got to research this vaccine and what it does and what the efficacy is. And you're learning these new terms and stuff. But then you had this foundation of like being a political commentator, knowing how government corruption works, knowing how media dishonesty works. You have other stuff you can rely on while you're figuring this out. But I had Scott Horton on the show talking all about the Maidan Revolution and U.S. involvement in the coup over there in whatever, 2015 and 2016 and 2017. So then when 2022 comes around, oh, there's this whole thing going on in Ukraine. The entire general public is like seeing this for the first time. And now since I'm like, I've been on, you know, whatever at the time now, I've been studying this shit for 15 years. It's like, oh, I got a big comparative advantage because I actually know a bunch of shit about this. Whereas everyone just figured it out yesterday. So then I got a viral video with Joe Rogan breaking down how the U.S. led the overthrow of this government just a few years earlier. And nobody had been saying that. Like, so anyway, there was this kind of like timely advantage where I had this comparative advantage. Whereas, so for example, Rob, like right now, if you just go around and ask people about their thoughts on Israel and Palestine, people just know so much more about it than they did 3 years ago. Like, it's just a way more popular topic that people have talked about. And now, you know, not everyone, but like a huge percentage of people have listened to at least like a few podcasts or read a few articles or maybe even read a few books about, you know, the situation. But like on October 8th, that wasn't the case. And so there was a big advantage in being the one who like had read a bunch about it already, particularly in this industry or whatever that I work in. In the same sense, I don't know, I guess I'm going on a long rant just to say, it feels like so many people are like thinking about economics for the first time ever now. And it's just like, I don't know, I guess it's just, there's a frustration involved in being like, some of us have actually been thinking about this for a long time. So could you maybe just hear us out here? Because like, this isn't, it's just like so much of like today, like the internet and the craziness is like people who started thinking about this shit 5 minutes ago, screaming at you about how you haven't thought through the implications of this. And you're like, yeah, but I kind of have. I don't know.
Yeah, it is wild. The arrogance and disrespect of people online, you know, they're not like that in person, but the way that they talk to you, that they're so absolutely right and that you're dumb, even though they haven't actually comprehended with what you're saying. You delve in a little bit more. I've kind of learned that there's no reason to have conversations with these people because they never seem to actually contend with what you're saying or listening to you. So I just find it's not worthwhile. But yes, particularly in the economics lane, people that have never read a thing, researched a thing. They just seem to float towards the liberal ideas of, yeah, we got to raise the minimum wage, or yeah, of course government can step in and just make this free and fix the problem. And free is maybe an exaggeration, but you know, it's
well, they the way say it a lot. They yeah, say but, it. Yeah, they sort of do use that phrasing a lot.
But I'm just saying, if government can step in and make it less, then why can't it make it free? Why just less? I'm just saying. So essentially, the pitch is that government can fix it.
And that's there's this glaring, obvious contradiction in the middle of this whole thing. This is my point, where it's not like this is like being against lockdowns or saying that Joe Biden clearly has, you know, mentally declined or something. We're just right about this. It's like, hey, guys, look, you do. First of all, to the point you just made there, they're the ones who constantly say free healthcare, free education, free housing. They're the ones who insert that language. And Rob, as you know, and I'm not trying to pick on the dumbest arguments here, but like about 50% of the argument does come down to that. That sounds nice. That people just go, oh, yeah, what are you against free education? You're against free healthcare? You're against free? And it's like, no, dude, I'm saying that's not possible. You can't just wave a wand or write an edict. You can't write a law and make something free any more than you can cast a spell and make something free. Like it does. And then to your other point, Rob, it's like, no, right. So if you're telling me that price controls on interest rates can help the economy, that by lowering interest rates, as Donald Trump says, can help the economy, well then why the hell should we not use price controls all over the place to help the economy? As why should we not also have, and look, this is the thing where some people will be committed to this and just become full out fucking socialists and go, yeah, that's right, then fuck it. But if then at least be consistent with it here. If price control, if you're saying it's such a great thing to provide free healthcare for people, okay, fine. But then like, why isn't it also a great idea to provide free shoes and underwear and flour and eggs and, right? Like if this mechanism is at the heart of it, Rob, if you're not just being a child and claiming that it's free, what is the claim here? That this is what? A more efficient mechanism for delivering a service. Okay, well, if it's a more efficient mechanism for delivering a service, why not deliver all of these vitally important services that way? What's more important than food? What's more important than clothing? These things are much more important than doctors' bills to people. And don't get me wrong, like I'm saying, obviously to some people, a doctor's bill is vitally important, but to all people, food and clothes are vitally important. So why not? And my only point here is that, and this is why I said that no one can leave the room, you know, line before, because Rob, not a one of them have an answer to this. I've been waiting for 20 years. I've been asking this question. I, by the way, came into this libertarian world as a fucking liberal, leftist, essentially. I was a fucking lefty. I didn't read about shit. I didn't think about it that hardly. I was always leaned that way my whole life. Just because it was the lowest order thinking, right? Like the same reason everyone's a lefty. Yeah, of course I'm for raising the minimum wage, because like they should make more. Well, you're the bad guy who thinks they should make less. No, I'll be the good guy who thinks they should make more. Like it was, you know, but I'm saying like I got convinced of this free market shit it's like I got trapped into it by logic. I didn't want to be here. I just, you know, like eventually they just checkmated me. I just kept reading it. And then eventually I'm like, okay, hey guys, what's the answer to this? And then the guys, and no one had any backup for me.
Yeah. The starting point is you have to be interested or open to kind of a contrarian argument. Cause like, I guess the natural state of things is to be like, yeah, gun control. That makes sense. Like it's crazy. Everyone just has a gun. Like, I guess government should, you know, regulate that. It's crazy. People are just walking around with guns. Or healthcare. Yeah, that should be free. I want to be healthy. I want other people to be healthy. Why can't government do that? Yeah, government should provide that. That should be a base need. It's kind of like you could call it lowest level of thinking, or just like you're ingrained with the idea that government's good. And so you just hear these things, they sound right. And you kind of have to be open to well, let's delve into the details and if they can actually provide that. And then you got to actually be open to the contrarian arguments of, does government even really want to offer that to you? Or are they just looking for more control over a certain sectors that you're more reliant on them? And what's their track record of actually executing these goods to you? And once they step into a market, does it actually provide the goods better than the private market would? Like, what are the actual consequences of it? And then you got to actually like see the analytics in a way of the way it plays out when government it really just pretends that they're going to offer you these things because they want control. But you got to be open to the contrarian argument and then go, oh, logically, that actually makes more sense. Yeah. But if you're not willing to actually like entertain the thought of the counter perspective, it's impossible to see it as right, because it's just so easy to, you know, we're social creatures and there's social cohesion to what do most people think? Oh, most people think government, private companies are bad. The government's here to protect me from private companies. Since private companies are looking for profit, there's a fairer and better mechanism, which would be government providing it. It like, you know what I mean? It's just kind of, there's the social cohesion element, cultural element, and then just like, it's the lazier thinking of, oh, this makes me a nice person. This makes me nice that I think government should provide it. And you gotta just be open to a little bit of contrarian thought to go, oh, wait, is it nice for me to volunteer other people's wages for a good is that right to steal from someone else to get you a good?
Yeah. Well, you know what? Okay. So it's really interesting. Yeah, man. All that's really, really smart shit, Rob. It's reminding me. So I was reading just recently the other day, I was reading Carl Menger, who was like, he's a brilliant economist. He was like the, what's the way to put it? I guess I don't know if he was what exactly their personal relationship was, but I was going to say he was the mentor of Ludwig von Mises, but I'm not sure that claim is actually correct. But he was kind of like, maybe you would say like the founder of the Mises, or he was like the founder of Austrian economics. And then Mises really, I mean, Mises like took his work and made it into like an entire like brilliant, like cohesive school of thought. So he's writing about money, and it's just, dude, it's so interesting. Cause it's what you were saying just reminded me of it. Like almost just how counterintuitive it all is. Like you could see where like, look, just on its face, you could see where someone goes like, well, no, like a centrally planned economy would have an advantage over a decentralized, not planned economy or something. You know what I mean? But if you just like, think about for a second, money, just think about money and try to think about two things, right? Number one, what a multiplier effect money is. Like I was talking about this on the last episode a little bit, but like this is a very basic thing that we all kind of know. I think most people know on some level, but if you just think it through, because we don't think about it much, like the reason we have money and how much money allows us to economize, that like when you know what I'm saying? Like that when I go out to get my family breakfast, I don't have to find a breakfast place that wants libertarian podcasts. You know what I'm saying? Like that I don't have to directly exchange my service for them or for that. And that we have this currency thing. Right. And like, so the way Menger's writing about it, he goes, or maybe I can't remember if this was him or Bob Murphy, cause I was reading Bob Murphy talk about this, but anyway, he's talking about like the idea of, if you were to just describe this to somebody, right? Like, let's just say we lived in a barter system and you were trying to advance the idea that we should have money. But imagine thinking that I would go to you, Rob. So like the system here is like, okay, which is how markets evolved. So the system here is like, we're bartering. So maybe like, whatever, I don't know. You're a doctor. I'm a farmer. I need medical service, but you already have plenty of food. So like, I got to now go to whoever, you know, I got to go down to a general market and go try to buy something that I think you want. So I got to try to give them food for a thing you want. Right. So imagine I just proposed to you. I went, Rob, just fix my broken arm and I'll give you pieces of paper. Okay, you could see where like on the face of it, that would be like, wait, what? No, I'm not trading my services for something that's like completely valueless. And you go, no, dude, if we all agree, this will really help all of us, right? To do this. So like money already is this kind of phenomenal, interesting thing. It's 50% of almost every transaction today. And we don't even think about how ridiculous this would have sounded if the first guy got. So then Menger goes through like the evolution of how this happened. It's actually very interesting. But essentially what would end up happening is that barter economies would, there'd be a tendency, like almost in the same way that there's a tendency, as we all read through COVID, with the evolution of viruses, they tend to become more infectious and less deadly. And why is that? Well, it's just the natural evolution of the thing, right? Is that the more it, that means survivability. And so that means that it's that version, that variant is going to survive more. Because if you kill the host, you don't transfer as much. Okay, so with barter markets, what ends up happening is that you end up wanting to purchase certain things that it's more likely other people. Yes, things that you could store that other people are more likely to want, right? Because that'll be more likely to get you. So like if you had, say, like eggs or something like that, you're like, man, eggs are food, man. Pretty much everybody will eat eggs. Everybody's got to eat every day. You'd be like, okay, well, if I have a lot of eggs, most people will take that in a barter system. But what's the problem, Rob? You can drop eggs. Last. They can break. They don't last. They spoil, right? So it's like, so you can see where like gold just like it just goes into being this perfect thing that like, oh, it's divisible. Yeah, okay, a lot of people might want a donkey, but what if I only want to give them half a donkey? Well, I can't cut a donkey in half, but you can cut a gold bar in half, and you can't, you know, you can make coins out of it. So anyway, the point is that essentially that's the ancestor of money, is that the ancestor, yeah, I guess would be the right way to put it, is that the good that's kind of easily bartered, the one that cigarettes is that can be stored.
You got the option of consuming it, and then you can store it for a while. And since someone can always consume it, that means it's got inherent value.
Right, right, exactly. And so anyway, but I guess my point, even something like that, right, like you'd even have to be willing to like entertain a really counterintuitive kind of view of things, even to just, I don't know, like even to get that stuff. So yeah, I don't know. I guess there are like some prerequisites to what type of mind is even open to hearing these arguments. But at the same time, that number isn't zero. There are people out there who are open to hearing this shit. I was one of them. There must be more like me, Rob.
I it almost just comes down to a willingness to entertain an argument of like an interest in like truth and wait, does this make sense? Versus kind of just a more emotional social cohesion thinking.
Yeah. And it's, again, like, yeah, they really, I do, like, there's, I want to say this the right way. Of all of the people, like, all of the, say, like, commentator class who just really disagree with our economics, our, you know, however interventionist they are, they're much more socialist than we are. It's like 90% of them, 95% of them don't even have a response to the argument. Like don't even have like a counter argument to it. And then the other 5% just have like a completely wrong one. Like maybe they have, you know what I mean? Like read some socialist argument about what, but it's all just nonsense and wrong. And like I said the other day, it's, and this is a really crazy thing to me, man, but it's like, it's all based on the labor theory of value, man. This is the whole justification that Karl Marx used was based on the labor theory of value. It's not like one element of his, like, look, with Adam Smith also believed in the labor theory of value. No, they're both just wrong about this. But Adam Smith, his arguments about like the invisible hand, all that, not for the benevolence of the butcher does he provide the meat to his neighbors. All that stuff is still spot on. So the fact that he didn't understand where value was derived, did it, but Karl Marx, so much of his view of the world rested on this fact that you're essentially inherently being exploited if your labor, That and that is so reliant on the idea that you are creating the value, and then the capitalist class is ripping off the excess value of that, right? Like, this is their entire worldview, Rob. It's a, this foundational view that profits are a form of theft, that if you're making money, I'm stealing that money from somebody else. But that's just not true. It's the idea is disproven. Comparison I used on the show yesterday, Rob, was to, like, in Europe when they used to believe that I can't remember what it's called, but they used to believe that clouds caused viruses. Like, there was like a belief that like the clouds were what made.
I can get into that.
And when they got, yeah, it's wrong. It's, yeah, Rob, you could go with that, or you could be a Marxist. It's up to you. Either one. I mean, it's just like, I don't know. It was just a previous thing that people viewed that's not true. And this is why Austrian economics is correct and everything else is wrong. Because you got to fucking start by just thinking this shit through. And if you don't start that way, you get everything wrong. I loved when Bob Murphy said back in the day. And by the way, I said that Bob Murphy said this once, and it was so great. And then Bob Murphy said to me once, he goes, "Hey, I heard you say that on a podcast. I don't remember ever saying that, but I'm right. Bob Murphy said this once." Bob Murphy doesn't remember saying this once, but he did say this once, and it was great. But he said that he was like, all science starts with like a priori understandings of things and thinking things through. It's nothing's ever purely like empirical. It's never just running tests. And he goes, even if you look at the scientific method, okay, the scientific method comes first and then the experiment, right? So like, it's like, and his point about the scientific method was, and the way he said it was, he goes, nobody ever claimed that Moses came down from the top of the mountain with the scientific method. Like, it wasn't given to us. So how did we get it? Well, like, we logically deduced that here's the best way to do physics is to run an experiment and then see if we can repeat this experiment or whatever like that. So like, starting with economics, you have to like think this shit through first. So like, first think about, what are we even talking about here when we're discussing this topic? And the Austrians are the only ones. They're like the only ones who get that right. So anyway, the point is, if you like, Rob, I don't know how to say it. Like, the Austrians came up with the subjective theory of value. The subjective theory of value is correct. It's the correct theory. Labor theory is wrong. And then there's the implications from that are enormous. I'm sorry. Go ahead, because I'm ranting too long. But I want to talk more about this because I just love it.
I'll just put an entirely different spin on it, which might be the better fight to have with Republicans, is instead of getting into the economic weeds, it's just, why do you have any faith in government's ability to execute this plan? Yeah. So what plan have they executed well in the last 50 years that has made the country better, where they put out a pitch of, hey, we're going to take care of this, where it's actually been successful? Can you show me the track record of where government steps into an industry?
Well, this is the thing, right? So that, right. And that is the way to use empirical understandings of things, is to go like, well, look, what's been demonstrated here by this track record, right? And no, I think you're absolutely right about that. I mean, that's a huge, look, there's two different things here. There's the theory of the whole thing. There's the reason why this is true and this is not true, right? And then there's the implications of the theory. But you're right. It's a certain type of person who's interested in that or is persuaded by that. And then there's the practical logistics of it that you're getting, that a different type of person is going to be persuaded by. But I do think that, look, that point is one of the really important ones here. And, you know, I think about it like, this is the way, like, sorry, go ahead.
I'm more saying, you can kind of pin the Republicans on, wait, so you want a larger government? You want a government with more control over your lives? That's what your conservative outlook is?
Well, this is why.
You think this industry needs more regulation? You think this industry needs to be overseen by government, and that's going to lead to a better result? I just feel like it's the Scott Horton attack, the left from the left and the right from the right.
No, listen, I get your point on that. That's a fair point. I mean, I think the thing is that J.D. Vance, as I played on the last episode, that's essentially what he's openly saying. He's saying, yo, I think the Republican Party is much more Alexander Hamilton than Milton Friedman. saying we're not really the small government guys. And then that, you know what I mean? And so it's like, oh, okay. Well, then it's kind of on us to point out that, like, well, first of all, yeah, you're not the small government guys. Correct. And you abandoned that a long time ago. And that's what we're living under right now. I mean,
and
which
that's
is kind
why
of
we have tariffs, reckless spending, and horrible foreign wars. So how's this working for you guys?
Well, but look, I mean, I do just think that on the theory part of it, look, it is important to combat that stuff too. And it doesn't, look, Rob, again, it's not the thing that I'm interested in, the reason I even bring any of this shit up is because it's not so much about just like having the argument, like, with, say, like, if me and you were just having like an abstract philosophical conversation about like how, look, dude, obviously, like, value is not created from labor, and this is not something that we need to run an experiment on. This is something we can think through and know with certainty. If you, right, and like that, if you, something only has value if somebody wants to buy it, right? And that you could work really, really hard on something, and if no one wants to buy your product, then there's no value, at least in this market there. And then you, right, and you could, but the reason why that matters so much is because there are people, much like I was 20 years ago, there are people who are like more on the left who don't haven't been presented with these arguments or thought them through, who, what happens is that then, Rob, they fall into, and this is really at the core of the problem of kind of all of this stuff, is that you fall into, like, if your view is that you're always getting ripped off if you're a worker, and that that capitalist is inherently stealing like your money from you, you end up getting everything wrong, and also just being a bad, resentful person. Like, it's just a terrible, it's incorrect on every level. Like, look, obviously, if like, even in an example of like, if you hire someone to clean your house, like, even an example like that, what you're doing is you're trading with them. You're trading their time and energy for resources, right? Typically, like we said before, typically we're using money because that's a lot easier, but the thing still works if you're giving them chickens. Like, you're trading with them. Trades are win-win. That's why people voluntarily enter into them. And so, like, the idea that you've taken something from that person is not true. That's why people clean people's houses and quite happily do it. And they will do it of their own free will if you allow them to. It's like the idea that if you go work in a factory, you can sit there and say, oh, I mean, it's like the most, you know, the shallowest, most childish way to look at that is to think that the arrangement there is that all the workers do the work and the guy who owns it gets to just sit there and skimp off the top. It's like, first of all, the reason why these people go there and work for them is because that guy had the factory. Okay. Now you could say that's unfair that he had the factory and didn't have that, but how did he have the factory? He took his money and purchased a building and bought machine. He made the capital investment that made this thing economically productive. If you believe in the labor theory of value, you're going to get this all wrong. You're not going to understand the equation here. So it's like, it's not that worker's labor just has all this value and the capitalist exploits it. The thing is, that guy's work at home in his bedroom didn't have any value in it. It only had value when it went into the factory and was given access to the machinery that could produce a product that other people valued. And you only had the ability to do that because of the capital investment. So no, the value didn't come from your labor. And then this guy skimmed off the top. You guys made a trade, your labor for access to his factory. And so there was more for both of you. It's like, otherwise you're just falling in a fixed pie bullshit. If everything was exploitation, how would there ever be economic advancement? How would it be the fact that we live so wealthy today and we used to be so poor in the future, in the past? How would that be if it was a fixed pie? It's not a question of it. This is economics. Isn't like, there's a pizza pie here. How many slices does everybody want? We're going to divide up pizza. And this is what leftists think of it like. So if there's a billionaire, you've seen, how many people have you seen talking about Elon Musk being a trillionaire, Rob, over the last few weeks? Like, that's inherently bad. the mindset is, well, he got seven slices. There's only eight slices total. Now there's only one slice to go around the recipe. But that's not what economics is. We're a pizzeria making pies. You want to produce things. If somebody brings four pies to the party, but they fucking eat six slices, they still brought a lot more than they ate. I think that's why it's important, though, for people to understand it.
I think the other pitch might be is you're being robbed blind. And so The pitch is like, listen, I'm not here to give you free stuff, but I'm to make sure that you're no longer being robbed blind. Inflation is robbing you blind. Corporations are engaging in regulatory capture, which is making sure that you can't get the health care that you're looking for. You're not getting the medicines you're supposed to get. Government is a racket that is working for these corporations and giving them free money at your expense, driving down interest rates. All like, you just got to kind of expose the corrupt racket of it, and kind of like, I want you to have more control over your life and live in a fair environment where you can earn an honest wage. And so what I'm going to do is go after all the corruption that exists here that's robbing you blind. And then,
that's right, bro. And look, I mean, that's a great way to pitch. I mean, look, there's several different like important things to hit on. You know, look, like the thing that I hit on opening yesterday's show, and I opened on it for a reason, is that I think it's also like the first important framing is that it's like, look, man, like everything you call the swamp, everything you call the deep state, everything you call the military-industrial complex, the Epstein class, the ruling elite of today. Well, you know what they love? Central banks and big government. That's their that is their current favorite tool of fleecing you guys. You know what I mean? And so, like, yes, that is what the establishment has given you. And also, I mean, Rob, you know, look, obviously, like, taxation is always a huge thing that you can point to that people, that really is like a very tangible thing that is robbing people and making their lives worse. But of course, the conversation around sound money right now is really more important than ever. I mean, this is kind of the crisis of our time, that the currency is being destroyed at such a rapid rate. And this ain't even the bust, Rob. This is the boom. So, geez, I mean, this is a major, major issue. And look, it's at the center of this is that it's like, right, like what we're talking about. Like, look, man, money is 50% of your economy, or just about, right? You think every goddamn economic transaction you make, money is 50% of what's being traded. And having that be sound, having your currency be reliable and stable is very important. And we're living through finding out what it is. And, you know, these like monetary calamities are not just like a libertarian like scare tactic or something. You know, like, this stuff happens. It's happened in history, like Zimbabwe and Weimar Germany, and right, like there's been examples where governments have destroyed their currencies and really, you know, wreaked havoc. Anyway. It's been very bad. Here, let me read from this. Natalie put up this quite a while ago in this conversation. And then if there are any questions in the chat, you can throw those in, Natalie, as well, if you see any. And we'll try to get to a couple before we wrap up here. But Tucker Carlson says, we need a third party. I'm going to help build a third party. There should be a good faith effort to figure out what benefits the country. If you make $60,000 a year, you're degraded. Carlson added, your life expectancy has gone down and the promise of your children's lives is likely gone. No one seems to care. It's not even a factor. What about Hamas? I officially don't care about Hamas. The U.S. government should have as its first priority the welfare of its own people. Well, look, that's exactly the right thing to say. And an America First party is the exact right note to hit. But again, you know, like what we were saying before, there's a huge devil in the details there. And look, this is stuff I'm going to talk to Tucker about, I'm sure. But there's, you know, like even I said it to Tucker like this. I can't remember if this is on air or off air, but I definitely said this to Tucker before. I think it was on air. That was like, because he makes the point a lot, which I totally get. This is not an unreasonable point that he makes. But Rob, he goes, Tucker goes, well, why is it that, you know, Americans are paying 35, 45, 50% in income taxes, and yet capital is taxed at 15%. You know, like, what? And look, on its face, that is a reasonable question. Like, it is reasonable to say, like, why is it, you know, the old Warren Buffett's secretary pays a higher percentage in tax than Warren Buffett? Now, okay, there's a lot of ways to poke holes in that, and obviously Warren Buffett is gonna, in his day, end up paying a whole lot more into the system than his secretary does. But the point that I made to Tucker was like, oh, okay, but the question here, like, we could even both agree on not liking the discrepancy in those rates. But the question here is, well, what do you want to do? Because there's two clear, right? Like, if you're saying, hey, the issue here is that capital gains tax is 15% and the personal income tax is 37% or whatever, well, there's two different ways that we could solve that problem, right? We could lower the personal rate, or we could raise the capital gains rate. And so, like, listen, let's just for a second, let's just examine both of those options, right? Okay. Number one, you raise the capital gains rate to 40%. Okay. Now, I don't think, well, I'm sure there's some lefty economists out there who really don't know what they're talking about and get everything wrong, but there's going to be some economic pain related with that, Rob. It's a lot of money to try to take out of the productive financial economy. Not even saying it's that productive at times, but it does do some productive work, and there's you're going to have some problems with that. But let's say best case scenario, that does not devastate your economy. You got, let's say you get more revenue in Washington, D.C. Now, again, that's not clear, that is not certain that that would happen. And in fact, you know, as I'm sure you know, Rob, the relationship of revenue and tax rates are actually a bit complicated. And every single time, I believe U.S. presidents have lowered tax rates, revenue has gone up just about every time. So the fact that you raise them doesn't necessarily mean revenue will go up, but let's just say revenue went up. So Washington, D.C. gets some more money. That's what you're telling me. The swamp gets some more money. This is your best case scenario. Washington, D.C. gets more money than any organization in the history of the world. How is that going to solve any problems? However, in my scenario, where we cut those personal income tax rates down to 15%, what did we get out of that? Oh, the greatest economic stimulus for the working class in America in American history. So like, let's do that one. You know, like, let's make sure, if we're going to agree on this problem, let's make sure we agree on that solution here, because it's obviously the right one.
Listen, before I say this, I want to make it clear, I'm against taxes. I'm not endorsing taxes, but some taxes are worse than other taxes. And sure. In my opinion, if you're taking your salary in stock, then it should be taxed as salary, because, like, you know, sometimes people rig the game where they're not taking, like, direct salaries. Whatever's your salary, because you earned, you're a wage slave, and that should be taxed. Capital gains on investment should be taxed at zero, because it's double taxation. And that if I actually earn money and I save that money, and then I decide, instead of spending it, that I want to invest it, why should government get a piece of the returns from my decision to go invest it? You already taxed me when the money was coming in. And in terms of just incentive structure, don't you want people to save and invest? Don't you want to incentivize a guy who's earned money to go put it into a business or invest in the stock market and save?
The logic of all of it falls apart. It's the logic of all of it, right? I mean, look, I know I use this as a go-to a lot, but it's a pretty obvious one. It's just, and again, this is why I just say Austrian economics is the way to understand this shit, man. Read Mises and Rothbard and Hayek.
And then property taxes on everything, because then you never own anything.
Well, look, you just go like this to a fucking, because here's the thing, and this is kind more or less the way Mises put it. It's hard to say. Whenever I say the way Mises put it, it's never going to come out that way, because Mises, I don't know if you've ever read Mises. It's very difficult to read.
I couldn't get
through. I've only read his stuff in English, obviously, but he's German, even in his English writing, if that makes sense. Like, he's just, his language is difficult. He's a difficult guy to read. But he's the greatest economic genius who ever lived. But so the way, like, he would put it is that, okay, so hold on, sorry. I kind of lost my train of thought there. That's terrible. But wait, I'm sorry, what were we just saying? It was just coming off of the last thought. Ah, Jesus Christ. I try to not do that.
You had a Mises take on taxes. That's where you were about to go.
Right. I was getting into the tax thing, but then I had a thing about Mises understanding incentives or something. Okay, yes. So Mises' argument eventually, ultimately, right, is that there are laws of economics in the same way that there are laws of logic, like there's the law of non-contradiction or something like that. Now, you can pretend that law doesn't exist. That's fine. But it does. And by pretending it doesn't exist, it just doesn't, like you're just ignoring reality, almost akin to saying, I don't believe in gravity and jumping out of a window. Like, you don't have to believe in it, but like, I'm just explaining to you that you are going to find out that it believes in you, whether you believe in it or not. Similarly, almost every liberal, almost every leftist, on some level, pretty much all support like taxing, let's say taxing cigarettes and subsidizing green energy. Just about every liberal or leftist will more or less concede with the objectives of that. Yeah, you want to subsidize green energy because we want more of it. We want more of it. We want more energy that isn't polluting or causing climate change or whatever. And we tax cigarettes because they kill people. We want less people to be smoking cigarettes. Okay, so they've already conceded economic laws, right? They've already conceded that, like, if you tax something, you're going to get less of it. If you subsidize something, you're going to get more of it, all things being the same. Okay, so what are we doing here, Rob? You're taxing work. You're taxing savings and investment. You're taxing owning property. Why the hell would we want less of any of those things? Why would we want? And then what are we subsidizing? Unemployment? So you're now you can ignore the economic laws of all of that. But anyway, so to your point, it's all crazy. Now, I'm not completely sure if I agree with your which is the worst tax argument, which is a long-running libertarian argument, and there are points on all of that. I will say, look, there's something philosophical about the property tax that I could argue is the worst. There's something about saying you can never truly own property if there's property taxes. And there's something about a government that tells its own citizenry that they can never truly be property owners, because if you're not, you're kind of a slave. That is kind of the, on some level, who's the old thing? Is it, was it Nozak?
I don't know that I'd put a capital gains tax over property tax. Those are the two top of mind. Cause then like even my car, I got to pay tax. That's like, I bought the thing and with money that I earned and you already taxed me on it. Now I owe money every year because I own the thing. And then on houses, it's really egregious because sometimes a bunch of rich people move to your area and now all of a sudden your house goes up and you can't afford the house that you actually purchased and live in because the government's going to raise your taxes and insurance rates go up. That's crazy. Like, then you can't ever own anything. You never have the security of this is mine.
That's exactly right. As I'm trying to, man, I can't, this is, I'd be embarrassed in my younger days if I forgot about this. But yes, it was Robert Nozick, The Tale of the Slave. And I forget exactly how it goes, but like the spirit of the thing is almost like you have a slave plantation and a bunch of slaves working picking cotton outside, and then there's the master, and then so like the master comes out and he goes, hey, good news, you're free. You're free now, you're not slaves anymore. And they're like, oh man, this is amazing. Like, yes, we're all freed, we're not slaves. And they're like, all right, you're now all like shareholders and property owners or whatever in the, you know, of the plantation. It's been 20 years since I read this, so I might butcher it a little bit. But so now you're now all like players, and you get to vote on, you know, who's going to be the slave master or whatever. And it's either me or this other guy. And so you have two options, but we're both going to run the plantation the exact same way and blah, blah, blah. And anyway, it's just like, he's basically like giving them, like, you're transitioning to giving them more and more like decision-making power, but you're still, and they're still taxing them. So it's like, you can't, and then you're just kind of like, we'd still like, you're still a slave. So in other words, if being a slave, this is kind of the spirit of the whole thing. If being a slave is essentially being 100% taxed and you can't choose what job you do, and you get, you know, room and board in very poor conditions, let's say, for your labor. That's all you get, and you don't get the choice. It's like, okay, but then like, all right, well, let's say they text you at 90% and let you keep 10% of it. Are you free now? Are you not? And then ultimately you just kind of get down. The point essentially is that there's not really exactly a clear objective free versus not free, unless you really have no taxation. You have like true liberty. And that there's only kind of, there's like degrees of slavery. Some might be a little harsher than the others, but like if the government were to tax me at 100%, then in some sense, like if they were to just confiscate every dime I made in the last year, then in some very real sense, they've kind of retroactively enslaved me. Like, hey, I worked the whole time for you now. I wasn't working for you. I was working for me. So you in some sense tricked me into doing something. If you never really can own your house, you never really can, you know, there is, look, I'm not saying it's as bad as the treatment as slaves on a plantation or something like that, but there is something pretty crazy about the fact that like, even after you own a house, even if you pay off the mortgage, even then, you know what I'm saying? Like the government can still come take it away from you if you don't pay them. And even if you, and then you want to build a fence on it, you got to go pay them a little bit more so they can do it. When you do that, you never really own anything. And what is slave? What is the difference between being a slave and being a free man, other than property rights? It's starting with the most basic one, self-ownership, right? Like that is the essence of slavery, is claiming ownership of another person, of them. So it's like, first I got to be able to own me, and then owning me doesn't really mean that much if I can't have a house, you know. So that's kind of what liberty is all about. It ain't solved with any of these programs of taxation. Tell you that. All right. Got to wrap on that. We'll be back on Monday, back in the studio. What do you got, Rod? You got gigs this weekend?
I probably shouldn't agree to this, but if for some reason you're out in Newport, Rhode Island, there's some storytelling comedy show I'm doing 10 minutes at the end of. I'm pretty sure it's going to be a nightmare and I'm going to horrify a room full of liberals, but whatever. Good to get a rep in.
No, I kind of want to see it.
Next weekend, you and I are doing Texas. I've got a show in Galveston on Sunday. I'm going to be running the FBI entrapment scheme. And there's a ton of Porch Tour dates. You can find them all at porchtour.com.
Hold on one second. Just quick. I'm going to check on that.
Cool. I'm going to hop off. I got a little drive in front of me.
That's fine. Catch you later. You got it right. All right. Catch you later.
Peace.